If you were a college student in the 60s, no doubt you had piles of paperback books. Probably at least a few of them were from Grove Press, the avant-garde and counterculture publisher run by the freewheeling Barney Ross. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. This hour, a history of the Grove Press, which gave us Waiting for Godot, Zoo Story, and most of the Beat Generation writers, and a number of groundbreaking titles written by D.H. Lawrence, William S. Burroughs, and Henry Miller. Rossett and his press challenged the banning of these works in court and won, ending the widespread literary censorship in the U.S. We'll talk to University of Iowa English professor Lauren Glass, whose new book is Counterculture Colophon. But first, the news. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe.
Drove all night, came at dawn to a warm, misty place, barking dogs and the sound of running water. Thomas and Charlie, I said. What? That's the name of this town. Sea level. We climbed straight up from here 10,000 feet. I took a fix and went to sleep in the back seat. She was a good driver.
That's William Burroughs reading from his novel, The Naked Lunch, considered one of the most sexually explicit books of all times, one of the big money makers for the Grove Press, the publishing house led by Barney Rossett. Above everything else, Rossett and his press wanted to be avant-garde. No one can argue that it wasn't. It cleared the way for the American publication of many controversial books, from Lady Chatterley's Lover to Tropic of Cancer. Grove, located in Greenwich Village, became in many ways the symbol of U.S. counterculture in the 50s and 60s. A University of Iowa Associate Professor of English, Lauren Glass, has written a history of Rossett's Grove Press entitled Counterculture Colophon. Lauren Glass, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Happy to be here, Dennis.
Nice to have you here talking about your interesting new book, Counterculture Colophon, about the Grove Press, run for many years by Barney Rossett, a real character who lived well into his 80s and just died, what, a couple of years ago?
A couple of years ago, and he was high energy and cantankerous to the very end. I got to interview him twice before he passed.
So you got to talk to him twice.
That's correct.
How difficult was it for you to set that interview up with Barney?
It was a little difficult. He wouldn't commit until I actually had already flown into New York. His wife told me that it would depend upon his health, so I had actually scheduled other interviews with folks who worked with him, but I didn't actually get to discover that I would get to interview him until I arrived in New York at the Chelsea Hotel, which is where I used to stay when I was doing my research on that book. I open with that anecdote of trying to get my interview with Barney Rossett.
Describe Rossett for us, because some of us have heard his interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, probably a couple of those interviews at least. What was he like?
He was a real talker and an energetic and argumentative figure to the end. He also was a great raconteur. He loved to tell stories about China. In fact, that was what he began with when I came to interview him about Grove Press. It took him a while to actually get to that point in his life. He liked to talk about his experience as a signalman, as a camera operator in the Eastern Theater of Operations in World War II. He was stationed in China. He told me a lot about that. But he still he was a man of very strong opinions, and he was not afraid to disagree with anyone, including me. He wasn't always happy with the arguments I was making about Grove Press. You could certainly see the mover and shaker that he had used to be when he was a younger man. He was already in his 80s when I met him.
Lauren, you write that with Paris as Rossett's primary resource, New York as his home base, and the booming American university population as his audience, and I'm quoting you now, his signal achievement with Grove Press and the Evergreen Review would be to take the avant-garde into the mainstream.
Yeah, that is my principal argument, and that also is the sort of map on which I lay that argument. So when Barney bought Grove Press. This would have been in 1951. Paris was really the capital of avant-garde cultural production. With the exception, possibly, of painting, abstract expressionist painting had revolutionized the art world and had brought the center of gravity in many ways into New York and the Museum of Modern Art. But as far as literature and drama in particular was concerned, Paris was the capital. And Barney early on established connections with most of the major Parisian publishers and cornered the market really on the experimental drama that was going on there, such as Samuel Beckett and Jean Genet and other folks who were operating in the avant-garde world of avant-garde drama at that time. But it wouldn't have worked if he didn't have a large sort of built-in audience in the baby boom generation, the GI Bill folks that were just flocking to the universities in the years after World War II. And avant-garde drama, avant-garde literature became very popular on campuses in English departments, and the plays for performances in both an amateur and professional venues. And that was Barney's audience, was the growing population of young people on the university campuses in the United States in the 50s and 60s.
But certainly the United States was less welcoming to the avant-garde, at least initially, than France.
Absolutely.
So he had his challenges in exporting.
It was the youth. It was the younger people. It's true that the United States, particularly in the its Midwestern extensions, the cities are always different. There were little bohemian scenes and avant-garde scenes in a lot of the major cities, right? So New York, San Francisco, and even Minneapolis, St. Paul, any big city usually had a few blocks where there were coffee shops, paperback bookstores, and the beginning of a kind of countercultural or avant-garde scene. And those were initially the neighborhoods and the demographics to which Grove Press appealed. And then it was with the expansion of the university system that those populations of people interested in that kind of material really grew at a considerable rate.
Well, you mentioned paperback books, and this was a key.
Yes.
A real key to Rossett's revolution was the baby boomers loved paperbacks when they first came on the scene in the 1950s. He couldn't have done this without paperbacks.
Absolutely. It was really the intersection of the post-war baby boom and the GI Bill on the one hand and the paperback revolution in publishing, which accounts for the basic conditions of possibility for Grove Press. The paperback revolution usually dated to 1939. Initially, it was mostly small reprint in pocket size of books that either had already been bestsellers or classics that you could acquire without even having to worry about the copyright because they had exhausted their copyright limit. What Grove entered into and innovated were called quality paperbacks. We now call them trade paperbacks. And there were, in fact, many paperback bookstores which dealt exclusively or at least principally in that format. And it was quality paperbacks of figures like Beckett and other avant-garde writers who really were the initial market and the initial format in which Grove started their reputation.
Yeah, because I remember as a young kid, paperbacks used to be classics mostly.
Yes.
There wasn't much new stuff coming out in paperbacks. That all changed. But we're going to talk a bit about Rossett's reissues of many classic, almost pornographic titles.
Yes, he did that too.
And the list goes on and on of those books. We'll get to that here in just a few minutes. But when you visited Barney Rossett in New York, and you say he was living in very modest circumstances, and according to at least one obituary, he was almost broke when he died in March 2012, which is really interesting because when he started as a young man, he inherited a ton of money from his father, squandered most of it on Grove Press, his baby, over many years. He was not a very good money manager.
No, and I think in some ways Barney's political principles were in some ways in conflict with his inherited wealth and his class position. And you're right, he squandered most of his fortune on Grove Press, and I think that was deliberate and part of his temperament as not a very good manager of money, but also part of his political convictions about wealth, about inequality and wealth disparity, as we still have an issue today, it's even worse. But Barney, a lot of people felt when they had read my book that it seemed as though Barney were trying to profit off the counterculture or was exploiting the counterculture. But I think that's really not true. I think Barney threw heart and soul himself into his publishing company and was willing to lose his fortune on it, which he indeed did do. When he was fired, he didn't have very much money left. He was in debt. And yes, he did die in modest circumstances. I'm still in touch with his widow. And what he left was a lot of stuff, not a lot of money. And Astrid is still trying to find a library or a location for some of the material that he left over in what was a very small walk-up apartment in the village, very modest abode that he lived in for the last decades of his life.
Well, it seems to me unfair to criticize him for amassing some fortune, because as you say, Lauren, he plowed it all back into the press, and it really his goal here was, I'm sure he wanted some celebrity for himself out of this. He had an ego. But he certainly, I don't think he, it was not about, never about the money, was it? I mean, really?
No, it was on the one hand about the literature he loved. It was certainly against censorship, right? Barney was what we would call a First Amendment fundamentalist. He didn't feel there should be any restriction on free speech, including, by the way, for libel or slander. He really wanted everything to be publishable, and he boldly published everything that he wanted to publish, and arguably almost single-handedly ended censorship for the printed word in the United States. Anybody in publishing would agree with that. There were some other cases of other books. You know, obviously he wasn't the only people involved, but Grove really put in the opening wedge, as well as, I'd say, putting the final nail in the coffin of censorship on freedom of speech, starting with Lady Chatterley's Lover, ending with Naked Lunch, and then going on into The Marquis de Sade, My Secret Life, all sorts of incredibly explicit materials that would have been unheard of to be published just a half a decade or a decade earlier. And he also was pretty much a left-winger. There were some gaps in his sensibilities, certainly in terms of feminism. He was behind the curve. But he published Fanon, Wretched of the Earth. He published lots of revolutionary handbooks. And in many ways, Grove was the publisher of the revolution, or the publisher of the counterculture. And at the time of great political volatility, and when many people felt that even some sort of world revolution was at hand, Grove was seen very much as publishing the material that would be necessary to have that revolution. I have a chapter on revolutionary handbooks, sort of back pocket handbooks that you might need if you were to, you know, be part of a revolutionary avant-garde. In some ways, Barney brings together, or Grove brings together, the political idea of the avant-garde and the aesthetic idea of the avant-garde. So they published many experimental literary texts, but they also published lots of radical political texts.
Is Grove still around today as a
Grove imprint? Is still around today, and in fact, it's one of the only surviving mid-range, independently owned publishers in the publishing world now. Right at the time that Grove came on the scene originally was a time of great incorporation and consolidation in publishing.
We need to take a short break. I'm talking to Lauren Glass. Lauren's new book, published by Stanford, is called Counterculture, Colophon, Grove Press, The Evergreen Review, and we'll get to the review in a few minutes. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, talking to University of Iowa English professor Lauren Glass, his new book about really fascinating publisher Barney Rossett, his Grove Press. Barney is a huge personality who died at the age of 89 just a few years ago. Grove Press out of New York, also the Evergreen Review. And we were talking before the break about the challenges to censorship, which was really maybe the key thing he was all about.
Ben. Oh, yeah. Although one could say, if, for those of us who know Barney's biography well, in some ways he set the whole thing up just to publish Henry Miller. He was a great fan of Henry Miller. He had read Tropic of Cancer when he was young and had just been dumped by a girlfriend. And he related closely to Henry Miller throughout the rest of his life and was determined once he started Grove to publish him. And in many – as those of you – when you read my book, you'll see he initially published Lady Chatterley's Lover just as an opening wedge to get Henry Miller published. And Miller probably posed the largest challenge of any other single author that he published in terms of the number of legal challenges that he had across the country at that time. So the publication of Henry Miller was really a turning point for Grove Press. Once they were able to successfully get that legalized, and that was would have been in 1962 –
But Miller was tougher. Miller was tougher to get through than D.H. Lawrence.
Yeah, D.H. Lawrence was already respected as a major British author with one book that people couldn't get a hold of. Henry Miller was less well known, certainly much more explicit and dirty, shall we say, and had less of an established reputation. What Barney learned quite quickly after the passage of the landmark Supreme Court law case of Roth versus the United States, was that if you could claim that the book had literary value, if you could get academics to endorse the book, then usually you could overcome any sort of challenge to its publication. So that was much easier with Lawrence than it was with Miller. It was in some ways easier with Miller than it was with Burroughs. But he benefited with Burroughs that it was already a little later in the day, and academics and people in the cultural industry were beginning to celebrate him, Norman Mailer, Mary McCarthy. But it was really once Naked Lunch was published, as Norman Mailer said, then we could do anything. There was no way. There's nothing more explicit than Naked Lunch. And that may even still be true. That may have been at the outer boundaries of what is even possible in terms of explicitness in prose. And so really after that, it was a free-for-all, and Barney published anything he wanted to publish. He also did a lot of explicit pornographic film.
Yeah. We want to get to the film here later.
Sure.
Because that was very interesting. He lost a lot of money on the film.
He made money on the films, and then he lost money on the films.
Yeah. Well, part of the challenge was if the United States courts deemed a work obscene, it was not protected by copyright, which seems awfully weird to me. Why, I never quite understood the logic there. But
it's correct, and it's one of the peculiarities of U.S. law, which actually hasn't much been written about. Copyright and obscenity and censorship actually have a relatively entangled overlapping history, both basically going back to the 18th century and the establishment of commercial publishing. But the relationship between them hasn't been studied as much as maybe it could. But it's true that part of the problem with Lady Chatterley's Lover was that it was not in copyright. So Barney actually ended up struggling not just to make it legal, but once he made it legal, he had to then struggle against a bunch of pirates and other publishers who wanted to benefit from his own legal triumph. And so then there were further cases about both the ethics of the trade and about intellectual property. And there's a lot of material that Grove published, actually, that was of, shall we say, dubious copyright provenance, but which he was the only person bold enough to publish in a mainstream commercial venue.
Well, he probably never got a chance to meet D.H. Lawrence, I assume.
D.H. Lawrence was long dead.
But he did get to know Henry Miller quite well.
He got to know Henry Miller fairly well. He went and visited Henry Miller.
How did he do that?
Well, he wanted to publish Tropic of Cancer. And Miller was at that time living in California, in a beautiful coastal location known as Big Sur. And Barney went to visit him. And apparently the first thing that that happened when Barney got there was Miller's wife at the time said, well, look, I'm going to suggest that he not do it because he always does the opposite of what I say. And that apparently got things going. But Miller was very reluctant to have Barney take this on because he presciently believed that then he would just be read by college students, that his books would lose the edge once they got legalized. And he was indeed correct. Henry Miller quickly ended up on college syllabi. He became a sort of countercultural sexual revolutionary hero.
That's funny. I remember my mother reading Tropic of Cancer. So there's She wasn't a college student.
Well, you know, there's a whole culture of dirty books that in some ways got ended by Grove Press, because when they were illegal, people used to read them surreptitiously. Mm. And this is before, obviously, the internet and before all the kind of access to pornography that we have now. So, in fact, getting Lady Chatterley's Lover or Tropic of Cancer, this was a way for some people to first learn about sex, to first learn about the language of sex, the explicit words that are used for sex. There's even a Seinfeld, if I remember correctly, about this, where Tropic of Cancer is handed, you know, back and forth amongst the high school students in Seinfeld's New York high school. So what Barney did by publishing all of this is in some ways took away the stigma and took away that kind of surreptitiousness and put them out more into the streets. Although I teach this material and some of my students are still sort of embarrassed to read Tropic of Cancer in public. They're afraid someone will be looking over their shoulder.
Oh, really? I'm surprised. That's really funny. After all these years, I'm talking to Lauren Glass, University of Iowa, English professor, about his new book about the Grove Press called Counterculture Colophon. Would it be fair to say that Barney Rossett, the publisher of Grove Press, pretty much made Samuel Beckett famous, or at least well-known?
He definitely made Beckett famous in America. And in literature, as in music, getting famous in America is usually where the money is. Beckett was surely Barney's most important discovery. I think we can probably say that someone else would have discovered him. And indeed, he was, of course, discovered in France before that. But when Barney came on the scene, it was still the objective of a publisher with cultural aspirations was to find someone like Joyce. Everyone wanted to find their Joyce, the sort of classic author on which they could build a stable or build a reputation. And Barney was sensed early that Beckett might be that man. He was encouraged by Wallace Fowley, his teacher at the New School. And he also ended up having a man on the ground, Richard Seaver, who was already in Paris and was familiar with Beckett's work. But yes, and I talk a lot about Beckett, not just because Beckett's one of the most important figures that Grove published, but also because Beckett and Barney Rossett were so loyal to each other over the entirety of their careers, and that this is really a much rarer occurrence now. Authors tend to be loyal to agents, not publishers now, and they move a lot from publisher to publisher. You don't have this kind of tight relationship, but Beckett really established Grove's reputation, and Barney was loyal to Beckett ever since then, and they were good friends, and Barney was the, you know, hosted Beckett for his only visit to New York City. And it was really felicitously for Barney established, having Beckett really established a reputation for Grove that made the obscenity battles much easier, because Grove could be – it could be proven that Grove published serious literary work.
Well, he hosted Beckett's, as you mentioned, his only visit to the U.S. in the summer of 1964.
That's correct.
And this was actually to make a film called Film.
That's right. And it's a minor masterpiece in cinematic history, Film.
Now, this is Samuel Beckett's play, a film.
Called Film.
Film. Just to clarify that, it's sort of confusing if you haven't seen it.
That's right. It's called Film, not unlike Beckett as a title, and it's certainly self-referential and kind of metacritical. It's about the only character in it is Buster Keaton, and he's being pursued by the camera throughout the length of the film. And I do have a whole chapter. Barney's interest in film was lifelong, and Grove's investment in film was considerable. It's not something they're as well known for, but I have a whole chapter both on the films that Barney produced, as well as on the little film books that Grove produced. We don't really use these anymore because we have DVDs and videos. But before then, a lot of people couldn't catch the foreign films that were all the rage in New York City. And Grove tried to address these audiences by publishing highly illustrated little film books on things like Kurosawa's Rashomon.
And these books had the screenplay, all the dialogue and the whole –
They had all the dialogue and the screenplay and the images, even four movies, by the way, which didn't have much of a screenplay, right? A lot of experimental movies. Someone like Godard frequently worked on the fly. And indeed, what they would have is actually scripts of the movie done afterwards, not the original working script, which frequently didn't match very well with what ended up coming up in the movie. So it was a very challenging sort of hybrid form to make these film books. Another one they did was Hiroshima Mon Amour. But those film books were quite quite remarkable. I collected a bunch of them.
You don't see film books much anymore, do you? I mean, are they even published?
There are books obviously about in fact BFI has a series of books. You know, there's one about The Matrix or whatever, but these are critical books about the films. These books were meant to substitute for watching the film for people who couldn't get the film.
Yeah.
Or they were also used in film departments, which were new at this time, for the study of film, because it was hard. You know, it was harder when you only had actual film. It was harder to stop and start and focus on given frames. So this was a way of being able to freeze frame and basically read a film the way we now can much more easily with a DVD. We don't need this format now, because we have DVDs. But I talk a little bit in the book about the way in which these books actually anticipate some of the structures that DVDs have, some of the things we can do with DVDs. They were trying to do this with the books.
I was just going to say Buster Keaton, and had to be really old at that point, I think.
It may have been the last film he made. Certainly it was one of the last films he made. There are some very nice pictures of him and Beckett together on that set. And it's not clear he completely knew what was going – you know, the movie – whether he was on board with what the movie was trying to do or was about. But by all accounts, they worked relatively smoothly together. And it – you know, certainly his image didn't hurt the film in terms of giving it a kind of celebrity status when it went on the festival circuit.
Talking to Lauren Glass, his book is Counterculture Colophon, the history of the very, very interesting Grove Press. It's still around, but it's nothing like – in its heyday of the 50s and 60s, run by a gentleman named Barney Rossett, who died just a couple of years ago. We should mention Grove Press published Jack Kerouac and also Allen Ginsberg, the first edition of Howl.
That's correct. They published its first nationally distributed version. It's a little bit of a complicated story, but first of all, we should affirm Grove was definitely known as the beat publisher on the literary scene, right? So City Lights did the poetry, but Grove did a lot of the prose. They did most famously the Subterraneans, which was the Kerouac's book about an interracial affair that he had in the 50s. They didn't publish On the Road, but they published probably about half or maybe a quarter of Kerouac's prose output. And then most of the beat poets appeared in the Evergreen Review, including Ginsberg. So the second volume of the Evergreen Review, this is a classic volume, one of the only ones to go into reprint, was called The San Francisco Scene, organized mostly by Donald Allen, who was a very important editor for Grove in those early years. And it had both Kerouac and Ginsberg, as well as a bunch of other poets that would be associated with the Beats and the San Francisco Renaissance. And at the time, the City Lights version had been impounded because the book had just been accused of obscenity in San Francisco. So when it came out in the Evergreen Review edition, it had technically already been published by City Lights, but it wasn't actually being distributed. So this would have been the first time also that all these folks appeared together as a movement so organized. And then, of course, in the next year, they would publish The New American Poetry, edited by Donald Allen and still recognized now as one of the most important post-war poetry anthologies ever published.
I think I still have Lawrence Ferlinghetti's book
published by Grove.
I carried that around. I must still have it downstairs somewhere.
I think a lot of folks have those books in their attics or wherever.
You quote Barney Rossett as referring to Allen Ginsberg's Howl. He says, "This is the most radical thing I've read in America since I've come here."
Yeah, that was Fred Jordan speaking to Barney Rossett. They apparently received it and went to the Cedar Tavern, which was one of the many bars in which Barney would hang out in the evenings in New York City. And they were actually having lunch and read it together, yes. And Fred Jordan, who was the editor of the Evergreen Review, and by the way, should be given a lot of credit too. Barney is sort of the heroic leader of this group, but there was a whole cadre of folks who worked under Barney who were very devoted to him, who were very devoted to the press. Fred Jordan was one of these men, but there were a number of others. I was able to interview most, though not all of them, And their devotion to Barney, their pleasant, you know, their fond memories of Barney were very touching. But it also reminded me that although Barney is the sort of gargantuan personality, it was a team effort, and these people really worked together and were had a shared mission to bring the avant-garde into the United States and also to foment and enable left-wing political developments that were going on then. Remember, this is the height of the 60s and the counterculture, and also the height of reading in the United States, one might say. We're now much more of a multimedial country, much more of a multimedial world. And the idea that reading one book, you know, that you could read The Wretched of the Earth and understand revolution, I don't think that we have quite the same relationship to books. So I sometimes think of Grove as appearing during a kind of apotheosis of reading, when people really felt that reading would change their lives. And they published the books that people felt that about.
Are there collectors of Grove Press
Grove
books?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm one.
You're one.
But my collection is fragmentary. I have a lot of the most famous ones, and I used those to make copies of the covers for my own book. A lot of those are my own scans. But there is somebody else. I don't know his name. He's took down his site. He had a bunch of – so the Grove Press book covers are famous not just because they're of – great books, but because they were all designed by a man named Roy Kuhlman, who had a very signature abstract expressionist style. And that was a really going style then, and it gave Grove definitely a distinctive kind of brand recognition in the field.
You can spot a Grove book from a block away just from Kuhlman's.
Absolutely.
Beautiful, and, beautiful work, really.
Incredibly beautiful work. Yeah. And I know his daughter is working on a coffee table book of his work. Syracuse University has had a couple of exhibits based on their archive that has a lot of his books. I have an exhibit actually on the Post 45 website that has some images from my book, and that'll also give you the history of some of Kuhlman's really wonderful classic covers. And yes, other people have collected Grove Press books.
Well, Lauren, we need to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute. I'm talking to Lauren Glass, University of Iowa English professor, and his new book is Counterculture Colophon, Grove Press, The Evergreen Review, and the Incorporation of the Avant-Garde. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute.
Crazy. I knew you'd come up with something cool.
Dog of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe. I'm talking to Professor Lauren Glass of the University of Iowa. He has a new book about a most fascinating publisher by the name of Barney Rossett and his imprint called the Grove Press, really big in the 50s through about 1970 or so. The baby boomers will remember mostly the paperback editions of many of these classics, some of them pornographic in nature. And as I mentioned, a very interesting man, Barney Rossett. Well, there were five Grove Press authors who won Nobel Prizes in Literature.
That's correct. Pablo Neruda and Octavio Paz, two of them, and then, of course, Samuel Beckett.
What about Grove and the Black Power movement of the mid-60s to late 60s? Well, did Barney make this a priority in his what he's publishing?
They definitely did. And this was not only Barney. This was also Harry Braverman and Jules Geller. These were figures who had been active in the Monthly Review Press and were definitely, revolutionaries, hardcore Trotskyist socialists at that time. As I said, Barney published Fanon, which became a revolutionary handbook with the growth of post-colonial wars of independence across Africa. Fanon became a classic text, and anyone who wanted it in English, this was Grove Press became the resource. They published almost all of the well-known work by Fanon. But most famously, Grove ended up being the publisher of the autobiography of Malcolm X. This was not originally the intended publisher. Alex Haley had went with Dell, if I remember correctly. But when Malcolm X was assassinated, they didn't want to publish it. So Barney Rossett took it on right away. And
A mistake. I was going to say, the reading thing. What were they thinking?
It was one of his better. It sold. Although the salesman, the Nat Sobel, who did sales for Grove, actually told me that when the hardcover of the autobiography of Malcolm X came out, that it was in fact difficult to market, and that the New York Times actually promoted the autobiography of Sammy Davis Jr. instead on their front page. And he insisted that the difference between 1966, when the hardcover was published, and 1967, when the paperback was published, which is really the classic version of the autobiography that we're all familiar with, that was a really big change. But I got the sales figures. They published hundreds of thousands of copies of the autobiography of Malcolm X, and they also marketed it quite explicitly to colleges and even to high schools. They definitely they emphasized its sort of self-help elements, and were really – it's not just that they published it, but they were central in promoting it. And then in the later 60s, they published a lot of both material about Black Power and as well as material by, for instance, Amiri Baraka and other figures in the Black Power movement. And I suppose it's worth noting that for all of Grove Press's radical credentials, they were run – the press was run mostly by white men through most of the 60s, although there were a lot of women who worked there and a lot of women whose memories of working there were very positive.
Well, this is where a lot of people say he really dropped the ball. He didn't do much for the feminist revolution.
I guess all he did for it was be the object of their takeover.
And their takeover in 1970 when they actually took over his offices.
That's correct. They took over his offices, and they also – Robin Morgan, who was a big mover and shaker in the downtown scene and a women's liberation activist at that time, she and a group of other women took over the press, and she also agitated to have a union on in Grove Press. And Barney tried to cooperate with the union part. He would go to the meetings, and when the union vote finally was held, they voted down the union, that the employees decided not to join the union. Robin was definitely fired for her union agitation, and Barney was very saw her as an antagonist and an enemy. And that's – my book ends with that strike and takeover, because although Barney continued to own the press for really the next decade and a half, it was really hobbled by that. And, of course, political times changed as well.
But of all the women who took over his office, and he was out of the country at the time and was not happy about that, she was the only actual employee of the press, wasn't she?
That is correct. She and five or six other folks were involved in organizing a union, and they were fired, and an arbitrator did confirm that. But the takeover was organized by her and a women's lib movement, and none of the other women were, in fact, employees of the press. You know, it was a street action. It was partly political theater. Wigman had taken over Rat, which was an underground magazine, only a few months earlier, and the women had issued a few women's lib versions of this. And this was, this was what was happening in the counterculture and the New Left at that time. In many ways, the most radical turn was the women's lib movement, when a bunch of the male heavies, the leaders up to that time, had to realize that they had their own political problems that needed to be resolved. And Grove Press was in some ways underwent a process, a sort of symbolic process that was part of what the New Left in a larger sense was going on.
Well, let's talk quickly about his foray into film distribution. This is where he lost a ton of money.
Yes.
A ton. And it didn't seem to make too much sense to me why he started this. He was doing so well with the books, but there was just one movie he made some serious money on. A porno film, I guess it would fall in that category, even though it's probably, by today's standards, pretty mild.
Oh, very tame.
I Am Curious Yellow. But he did make some money with that. But this was in the age before DVDs and even video cassettes. So it was selling actual movies.
Right, actual film reels.
Reels, yes.
So first of all, Barney had been fascinated with film from a very young age. He had worked in the Army Signal Corps. He had learned how to make movies when he was in the Army. He actually produced a movie called Strange Victories in the years after, in the years immediately after World War II, about segregation in the United States. So I suppose one should say that his race politics credentials are strong too. He was – so the Strange Victory was about the fact of the, you know, contrasting the integration of the armed forces with the persistence of segregation in the United States. So once Grove got on its feet as a publisher, Barney was looking for ways to do film, and he wanted to do avant-garde film. He wanted to do the same thing with film that he had done with books, which was bring the avant-garde and the pornographic into the mainstream. And he made $14 million on I Am Curious Yellow. He showed it across the country, and he had the clever idea of remunerating the lawyers with parts of the ticket take. So in any given city, he would hire a lawyer and say, basically, you win the case for me, and I'll give you some of the profits from the movie. This worked incredibly well. It was selling to lines around the block in New York for months and months and months. But what Barney did after that, he was so energized by the money they made, is that he plowed all this money into all sorts of different, both foreign film and pornographic film, educational film, film about the ghettos. But he tried to do a type of video rental before the channels and the sort of modes of distribution were in place for that. So he showed movies in theaters, and, you know, they had festivals on college campuses, but he also wanted you to be able to rent pornographic, you know, reels of film from Grove. And this really didn't work very well. And I've since realized that there was a compounding problem, which was that Barney, who is always actually forward-looking and anticipated, I think anticipated video rentals and anticipated the mainstreaming of pornographic film, all sorts of developments that he was unable to profit on. But he also wanted to computerize his inventory. And after I finished the book, I found out from some folks that he bought an enormous computer. You know, this is when computers were as big as rooms, and that it never worked. And so all through 68 and 69, apparently, Grove's distribution of both books and movies was impeded by the fact that they were trying to go onto a computer system that wasn't working, in addition to the fact that at this point, Grove, which was had a penchant for hiring radical youth who would get stoned on the job, had a terribly inefficient staff, particularly at the book club level and at the film distribution level. So things were really a mess by the late 60s.
Well, he was way ahead of his time in so many
ways. In some ways,
including
yes.
This film. You write that Grove embraced gay male writers and readers, publishing O'Hara, Ginsberg, many other openly gay authors. He really was progressive in that area and really gutsy, wasn't he?
Absolutely. He published John Retchie's City of Night, which was actually one of his fastest-selling books. Retchie actually didn't want it to be called gay fiction, and indeed it was partly seen as the literature of the underworld, right? It was about a hustler. They also published all of Jean Genet's plays and prose, and indeed it can be argued that Barney, through Genet, helped enable the figure of the queen to become the sort of literary, indeed quasi-mythical figure that the queen has become since then. And Barney really in his personal and professional life, championed gay male authors, gay male editors, gay translators. Richard Howard did a bunch of translating for him. He obviously, as you mentioned, published Frank O'Hara and Allen Ginsberg. So there's a real – one of the things I do talk about a little is that Grove in some ways was part of a sort of boys club atmosphere that was common in post-war the United States, the Beats and the New York School being good examples, where you have men who are much more open to male homosexuality but are still pretty deeply misogynistic.
Yeah,
so they weren't very
sure.
good on their sexual politics across the genders, but they were pretty good in terms of blending and blurring the lines between male homosexuality and male heterosexuality.
Okay, here's one thing I found really interesting and sort of couldn't quite figure out his strategy. And you write, Lauren, Grove channeled much of its catalog in the later 1960s, a catalog that was increasingly ballasted by pornography and erotica, exhumed from the Edwardian and Victorian undergrounds. Rossett's sources for this material were many. Why was he digging up this old porno from the 19th century? He just was obsessed with it somehow, wasn't he?
You know, one thing we have to say is that he obviously liked pornography. This is what Dick Seaver said. They were all wondering, why are we getting all this stuff? And they realized that Barney liked it. But also, in some ways, I think Barney was making a point. He wanted to get all that stuff out there. And if you look at the advertising, it was all about bringing books that had been expensive and restricted to an elite audience and bringing those into the mainstream. Barney wasn't even really actually necessarily claiming that you should read these or like these, but that they should be available. It was much more about access than content. Barney felt like this material should be available, and he wanted to make it available. I should also note that it was enormously profitable, right? This stuff, none of this material was copyrighted. Nobody had to be paid any sort of royalties, and they cranked it out fairly quickly. And as you can imagine, it sold very well. Material like My Secret Life and The Pearl, The Lustful Turk, and all sorts of titles that he got from Olympia Press. And I should say, by the end of the 60s, people in the press were just writing this stuff themselves and making up funny names of authors and making up the blurbs. It was all part of this explosion that was the sexual revolution, when people sort of thought if we could just sort of get it all out in the open, all our hang-ups would be over. It was, of course, untrue, but it did change the whole way in which we access this materials. Pornography used to be hard to get a hold of. You used to have to have a certain amount of money. It was mostly available to men who were wealthy or had the wherewithal to search it out. Now it was just available over the counter anywhere, in the drugstores, just, you know, for the taking.
You note that he published an 11-volume anonymous autobiography called My Secret Life, documents the sexual exploits of a Victorian gentleman whose identity has never been established with certainty. I thought it was very weird. Do we know who wrote this?
There's people who have theories about it, and one of the theories is put forward that the man himself was a pornography collector from the late 19th century. My Secret Life was something of a publishing phenomenon. It came out at the same time as an academic study of Victorian pornography called The Other Victorians, which was about the Victorian pornographic underground. And that book fomented a lot of interest in other titles from this period, right? This is a time when these books were all dealt under the counter to frequently to private collectors or wealthy gentlemen. And so Barney, after the publication of My Secret Life and the successful reception of that, both critically and popularly, and by the way, My Secret Life was reviewed both in the New York Times but also in Victorian Studies. It was published in daily papers across the country. It was discussed by academics. But it generated this interest in the underground. And in fact, Grove Press had a whole campaign of joining the underground. And part of joining the underground was reading Samuel Beckett and Jean Genet, as well as reading My Secret Life and the autobiography of Malcolm X. And so one component of this was publishing all of these texts which previously had been unavailable. And certainly Barney was interested in that stuff. I should say that Barney was also part of a sort of Jewish tradition in doing that. Pornography publishers had frequently been entrepreneurs, Jewish entrepreneurs in publishing, who were able to actually sort of make both their names and make a certain amount of profit by publishing on the margins. And to a certain degree, Barney brought this kind of role to a certain kind of apotheosis. I should stress that Barney, who only his father was Jewish, did not consider himself Jewish, but many New York Jews worked for Barney, and there's a long tradition of Jewish publishers on the sort of margins of the modern publishing scene.
We're just about out of time, but quickly, Rossett was convinced the FBI was out to get him, but you said no evidence.
Well, so there is considerable evidence. There is no doubt. No. So Barney, as you can imagine, there's a whole section of Barney's archives on freedom of information requests. I didn't have the time to look through all of them, but they start during his time in the army. He was immediately seen as a possible case of disaffection or political subversion, and so he has a paper trail of both the FBI and CIA and as well as the army intelligence of tracking him. The question is whether they had anything to do with the strike. So there's a long docket on Barney Rossett in the American intelligence archives.
Lauren, you say Grove Press is still around, but it's not what it used to be. What is the significance of Grove Press? You've done an entire book on it now, a wonderful book. But how important was Grove Press to American culture maturing in mid-century,
crucially important, although some people might have thought it was degrading as opposed to maturing. I mean, Grove Press was the communication center of the counterculture. They were one of the only publishers ever in the history of publishing to achieve an independent identity so that people would buy books by that publisher as opposed to by the author. They also, of course, ended censorship, and that in and of itself would be enough of an achievement, and Barney is still celebrated in publishing circles for having done that. But the larger argument of what they achieved is sort of in my title. They brought avant-garde texts and avant-garde sensibilities into the mainstream so that you can now write sexually explicit materials, you can write experimental materials, and you don't have to be as worried for being politically exploited, you know, politically brought down upon. So their legacy is broad and wide, and I think anyone in publishing would recognize that.
Lauren Glass, thanks so very much.
Nice
really
to be here.
Really appreciate it. Lauren Glass, University of Iowa Associate Professor of English. His new book, published by Stanford, is Counterculture Colophon, Grove Press, The Evergreen Review, and the Incorporation of the Avant-Garde. We had help today from Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And that's Talk of Iowa for today. For Charity Nebbe, I'm Dennis Riz.
Some people like to rock. Some people like to roll, but me, I like to sit around to satisfy my soul. I like my women short, I like my women tall, and that's about the only thing I really dig at all.
Well, man, well,
I belong to the B generation. I don't let anything trouble my mind. I belong to the B generation, and everything's going just fine.
Weirdsville, yeah.
Some people say I'm lazy and my life's a wreck.